Interview with Roberts, T.W., 9th of November, 1965. Interview begins abruptly.
And turned out in the end that those things are the fables. The business proprietor, he would take a man from the town and put him on the land, and he couldn't work it with success against, compete against the produce of the big estates run by slave labor. Mm-hmm. You follow?
Yes.
All that sort of thing was just something like what we had in Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
When the getting title by prescription, it comes from the Roman law.
Mm-hmm. I see. And yet I suppose it was unavoidable, but this sort of education and upbringing separated you from the peasantry.
Yes, I think so, because they had no culture.
How did you first, as you say, you didn't like working the outstations, the solitude in the outstations. Where was this? What station?
That was at Martyr and Radnapura.
You felt like resigning at it?
Hmm?
You say you felt like resigning at it?
Yes, I nearly did resign. That was also because I was alone with my family in London.
Oh, I see.
You see? Wife and child and two children in London. And no, at that day, no, sign of any way to bring them out. It wasn't till my boss, Murty, got hold of Mrs. Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Ellis came around, she was the wife of the Controller General of Revenue, and a New Zealand woman, rather nice woman. Murty says, my assistant, thinking of resigning, can't you do something for him? And they said, yes, we'll get the government to advance him the money to bring them out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that the prevailing shade of thought in the CCS was largely Tory.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by when you say that Labour and Liberal supporters were more inclined to give popular movements more facility?
Yes, I suppose. Where the man was a Liberal or pro-Labour man,
mm-hmm.
he would be in favour of the popular movement there.
That's political.
Yes. Most of us. For instance, the Irishman I knew were definitely more so than the Englishman.
Oh, yes. But there are many Irishmen there.
Oh, yes. Not many. Ellis was an Irishman. That Ellis who was.
Yes.
And Murty, my boss, and Conroy, one or two others. Not many.
Now, as an OA,
mm-hmm.
did you go out into the field much?
Very rarely. Once, 6 months, say.
So you think that you should have gone out?
Oh, yes,
you
should have gone out more. But poor G.A. didn't have much of a travelling boat. And he had to use it for himself. He was often a hard-up fellow. Murty would never have brought a man money. You follow? He had some sisters he had to help, I think.
Now, when I put this question about this British habit of pragmatism, of rule of thumb, you say there is no other way. But what I was asking was whether it was pushed too far. Couldn't there be more instruction and discussion, whereas you were just sent out without any instruction at all?
No, but we used to get instruction. Murty would have me to dinner twice a week, and we would talk over things.
Mm-hmm.
That was the instruction. And what's more, now a very interesting thing. Listen, there's a very able Englishman named Thorpe who was district judge in Martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And he was firm on this keeping the Crown land protected. He wasn't in favor of giving any chainers, licenses to people. Now, Murty was inclined to give every now and then a few fellows a license to.
This was according to whim.
Hmm?
Was this according to whim, Murty's whim? I mean.
Yes, there was a certain. The government rule was don't give trainers, mostly, but where there's great need of valueless land, you know,
but wasn't most of the land, say, in, especially in Hambantota district, rather valueless?
In Hambantota it must have been very valueless. Well, I don't know about that, I wasn't there.
Yes.
In Madras it was generally in good land, mostly good land.
And what was their definition of need? Need, you said.
Poverty. Every man was really poor. Headman said he was very much in need of a block of acre. He would give him an acre to plant and let him pay a rupee a year or something like that.
But you had to rely on the headman for
this. Yes, sure. It was the only thing you had to do. Well, but that sort of thing, the headman wouldn't be unkind to a man, you know. They weren't bad fellows like that.
I think I'll come back to that later.
But we used to, Thorpe and Murty used to be very furiously arguing about that. You know what I mean? I listened to them and learned something about it from them.
I asked this question about British administration being all too often near routine, because that's what Stairs says. It was, he even says, calls it blind routine, and you don't think it was so?
No, I don't think so. Fellows like Murty, how could a blind routine produce that irrigation scheme in Cornigal, 1,000 tanks? It's something nobody has happened. You follow what I mean? It was done by local labor, where the local Gansabauer rule. Government didn't put money up.
Yes, but...
That was a GA who, a man of his own mind.
Yes, but that was a fairly obvious thing, I mean, once they revived the Gansabauer in 1856.
To put a rule in that the Gansabauer could charge people, require labor from people, or else in place of labor, rupee,
well,
2 days' labor.
Well, that was a sort of old rule that was used for roads, and it was used by Ward and other governors.
Rule done, yes, but to give the Gansabauer power to put such a rule?
Well, it was advocated by at the top level in my period, in the 19th century.
Yes, but that's because Fisher, it's the first thought of applying it through Gansabauer, isn't it? That's not the rule of thumb.
At the same time, you say there is a tendency to preserve the status quo.
Yes, yes.
At what level? I'm not only speaking about the political level, but I mean in the local situation. Don't you think sometimes more innovationism was called for?
Yes, yes. But then that keeping the old system was peace. Otherwise, to bring in something new would lead to rows. If a Dobie House man went by going one man's house singing, there would be a riot.
Yes,
you
and know, I was not...
thing like that.
I was not talking in political terms. I was thinking on economic lines with regard to improvements, well, of course, as you say, Fisher's idea was, that's a sort of innovationist idea, that's an improvement. But was that a general tendency to work on Fisher's lines? Or were government agents and AGs more inclined to take things as they came?
I'll give you another example of a GA striking out on an absolutely new line. It was Brain who set the women in Caltra.
Brayne.
Yes.
That's right.
To using those reeds from the Bolgoda Lake to make hats. That was something quite new. Nobody ever thought of that. And because it's the material, raw material was there free, they can make them cheap enough to sell, you see?
Mm-hmm. No, but at the same time you say that the provincial or central headquarters tended to quash new ideas.
Oh, yes, yes.
Why?
Just because they save them trouble.
Yes, well, in a sense, well, partly laziness in that sense.
Well, not that anything was peace. You know what I mean? They went through.
Let sleep in dogs' life.
They were lazy men, that is not true.
No, not lazy in a personal sense, lazy to go to extra lengths.
They were a bit afraid of
trying something.
Jumping out on the new lines.
Uh, Now you say that at the same time efficiency was sometimes was sought as an end in itself. You say sometimes efficiency was sought as an end in itself.
Yes, some fellows were very particular about punctuality in the catchery or something like that, you know.
Now, to the question, wasn't there a lack of purpose and of drive in British rule, you say no. They all wanted to see the proletariat grow and thrive. Yes, but what I meant is, what were the concrete ways in which they tried to make the proletariat grow and thrive?
Chiefly by building roads.
This is a typical laissez-faire attitude, stimulate, open the path for commercial activity.
Yes, yes. They had no money to invest. But if people could bring their goods to market comfortably on decent roads, they must...
They would then grow. Or this was an emphasis on the material sense, in the material sense. Did they have any further conception of, not only mere educational improvement, but also politically, being able to stand on their own feet, and did they have a conception of self-government in the future?
I don't think so, they didn't think of that.
They didn't think of that, not in the Macaulay sense.
No. But they were all anxious to have more schools, and pressing government to open a school here and open a school there, you know, where there were not schools.
No, but they were not thinking in ultimate terms, what is the end of all this?
No, they were, I don't think they were thinking very deeply on ultimate end.
So, in that sense, they had no ideal or drive in that. Well, you see, what I'm trying to get at is,
what is the use of a GA with no money at his command having an ultimate end?
Well, I'm not thinking merely of the GA, but of the central government. Colombo.
I don't know exactly what the central government was thinking then. But Ridgway was a very able man. I'm sure he would, if he had any money, he would have spent it on furthering things. What next man? McCullum, along with Clifford, was very full of the commercialization of the lake in Colombo to facilitate dispatch of goods.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see there is some attempt at material improvement, but what I was getting at was that because they didn't have this ultimate idea, in a sense there's a lack of a lack of purpose in what they were doing.
Surely governments, when they set out to improve things, must improve it by improving material conditions. That's the only way they can improve. Otherwise, there might be more schools. I can't think of any way to achieve any ultimate end for a government to do it than by putting up more schools.
Now you say that the non-European civil servants were excluded from the substantive administrative posts.
Yes.
And this was partly because of the Calabar.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And partly because they were biased towards their own folk.
Yes, they had an idea that the British had a monopoly of administrative capacity.
Oh, I see. actually,
you know, I remember an article in the British Encyclopedia in which a Professor Keith of London argued that Negroes would never be good runners because something was defective in their instep shape. You know? In a few years later, Jesse Owens and others are rather blown sky high.
Did they also distrust the discretion of the Ceylonese and the colored in crisis?
Discretion? They thought they would give favor to their own folk.
Own folk, you see. Now, what is your opinion on this sort of
good fellows and one or two will be bad like us, yes. The others will be good.
And the trouble is they always catch hold of one exception and bring him up as a rule.
Well, as a matter of fact, they're quite good fellows. Two Bevans were decent fellows. There was only one crooked fellow called Loftus.
What was their principal argument?
Oh, that's Paul Pierce was a twister. He was an honest man, money, good fellow, but he would give judgment for single East against the British every time. Just like First Roberts would give judgment for Englishman against the single East every time.
Who is this?
First Roberts, my namesake.
Oh.
Other fellows like Bickmore and others were jolly good.
What was the principal argument used by the British officers and by Colombo against employment of Ceylonese? I mean, rapid Ceylonization.
Yes, they would favor their own kind.
That was the principal argument. Was there a question of status? You see, since the GAs were top with regard to status. It was. So
they took precedence in every social gathering. Or
so they didn't want Ceylonese GAs?
No, they didn't want Ceylonese GAs.
Do you think that many of the village councils fail to fulfill their functions adequately, the village councils?
No, I don't think so. I think they did a fair amount of work.
You say that there was not much scope for corruption. And I thought the general impression was that there was a lot of corruption.
There was a lot of corruption, but the subjects with which they dealt with didn't involve much money.
Oh, I see.
If he didn't bring people money to pay.
Do you think the work of the Gan Sabha's judicial tribunals reduced your work in the police court and district court?
I think so, a little.
But was it as much as anticipated?
No, I don't. Because if a Gan Sabha decision was wrong, they would provoke the wrong man to revenge, and that will lead to bigger cases, a lot more cases in the bigger court.
Oh, I see.
Do you follow?
I mean, were their decisions final?
No, they could have been appealed to the AGA.
No, but if one party disagreed, was it dependent on agreement by both parties?
No. So the idea was to try and get both parties to agree.
Arbitrate, yes.
To settle things, and they did settle a lot. But when they wouldn't agree, the president had to give a decision. Mm-hmm. And there was an appeal against that to the AGA, and I think again to the governor. Can't remember.
In certain areas, did cliques dominate these Gan Sabha? You know, headman, family?
Probably yes, I don't know about it.
Probably yes. And what were the current criticisms of the headman system? The current
criticisms?
Yes.
Just corruption.
Corruption?
Yes.
Anything else?
I suppose some of the headmen were too lazy to supervise the expenditure on roads, say. That they ought to, they ought to give it a certain amount of time.
You say that...
For instance, you ought to check the piles of metal, or piles of gravel, rather.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a pile of gravel, some headman might be too lazy to do it. Don't know.
You say that genuine dissatisfaction motivated the political criticism of this system. The politicians...
Yes, the upper the middle classes and the upper classes were disregarded. They didn't have any voice in the things.
So was there a question of jealousy?
Yes, a certain amount of jealousy, yes.
Because they attacked these people as feudal elements.
As
feudal elements. They called the headman feudal.
Well, they were a feudal element. Yes.
Yes, they were. But I was wondering whether they were also sort of motivated by, because they were educated, by a feeling that, that they were avant-garde, sort of, you know, that...
Who were avant-garde?
The educated classes, unlike the headman.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
And now, in your opinion, the Ceylon National Association was a solid body of respected folk. But what was the government's attitude to this body, Colombo?
I don't know exactly what the government thought, I can't tell you. But I think they were rather against them because they were very critical, you see?
Yes. Yes, you get this in Bose, for instance, there's a tendency to expect gratitude from these people for having got education and gone to England. And so they take criticism amiss. Don't you think this was pushing things too far?
Well, where a man had received his education in England, surely he ought to owe some gratitude to England, isn't it? I think that is really natural.
No, but I mean, it's the very basis of a liberal education is your ability to criticize. It doesn't necessarily imply just because you got education from England that you must not be critical of the British.
By all means, but you mustn't be hostile.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I mean, while you might be, if each sort of, say, each case must be judged on its merits, you may have received something from them which you value, but there are other things which you don't like and which you feel like...
Oh, yes, you're quite entitled to find fault, undoubtedly.
But one feels that they sort of resented these people finding fault.
I can't say I agree.
You didn't think that this was generally so of the civil service?
No, I shouldn't say that.
You think that, now for instance, the temperance meetings were political meetings held under the cloak of temperance?
Yes, yes. If our Saint Niger frankly told me so. He was the leader.
Yes. But, why did they choose temperance as a front?
He told me that there was no other subject which he could get the masses to be roused about, to show themselves in sympathy with the political movement.
Oh, I see. And weren't they also genuinely, some of them at least, genuinely want temperance, some of the Buddhist leaders?
Some of them, undoubtedly.
Mm-hmm. You say, sir,
Diaz was a temperance man. I seldom drank. F.R. supplied his drinks liberally to everybody. Mm-hmm. He was the most generous person. And he'd like to drink himself.
And what about, you said Sir D.B. was not, Sir D.B. Jatel?
He was a teetotaler.
Oh.
But he was...
not really interested.
It was an extraordinary thing. We had long meetings over framing the local option rules.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the body, he and D.S. and Guru Sami and others.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have consultations with the colonial secretary. He never showed much interest in the temperance there.
This was when?
When I was excise commissioner.
1920s.
In the 1920s, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Between 1920 and 1926. The S. Senator was a keen man then. He was the man who did most of the drafting of the local option rules.
Now, were these, because this were the temperance readers rather disliked by most of the civil servants?
Nobody disliked F.R. Senanaga. Everybody liked him. Nobody disliked the S. as far as I know. I don't think they dislike the Temple of Stephen, except insofar as there was a weekly attack in the press on the government for demoralizing the country with Arab.
What was civil servants' attitude to the Theosophists?
I don't think they had much attitude. They took no interest in them. Didn't regard them seriously at all.
You say that Sir Hugh Clifford distrusted the mob and the East.
Hmm.
Distrusted the East. What exactly do you mean by that?
Didn't think he could manage itself very well.
He couldn't quite grasp them.
Oh, he could grasp them. He was pretty sharp grasping them, but his grip was that they wouldn't work. They were too far. They were too savage. The relations between Tamil and Sinhalese, the relations between Sikh and Muslim, the divisions were too deep. Hatred was too deep.
Well,
they could never work.
But you get that in the West too.
Yes, you get that in the West. But
so, well, he's by analogy, I mean.
But in the country, not in the country, in the country. The rancor between the Scotch and the British and the English is not like that. It's between the division, dislike between Sinhalese and Tamil, or between Muslim and Sikh, is very much deeper and violenter than between Scot and Englishman.
And what is your opinion on the implication in Clifford's dispatch? Because it's really,
I don't know what he wrote in his dispatch.
Well, by implication, they deny that self governing deny that Ceylon was ready for the self government.
Yes. Indeed, he was not ready.
No fight to begin.
Oh no, it should begin, but not. He was wrong about that. If he said it shouldn't begin, but it shouldn't be complete.
Yes, obviously, and I mean this mainly. Their stand was that the memorialists wanted a share of a finger in the political pie.
Yes. They should have it, and they ought to have it. That's the point. They ought to have it. It should never have been resisted. The government all ready to give them some share in the fight.
Their argument was that the educated class didn't represent the mass of the people, which had obviously had some basis. But what I would argue, what I'm arguing here, is that, for instance, the Magna Carta was a selfish baronial document.
Yes, no doubt that was altered by the middle and upper classes.
And you see, they argued that the GAs and the village headmen could represent the people better.
That is a false argument.
Yes. But of course, I think it was real. I think they believed in that.
I think they believed that, yes.
Though it was also a very useful argument for them. Now, you know, if I may sort of come to the 1915 riots.
1915
riots.
Yes.
You say you do not believe it as an organized conspiracy against government, as such.
I think I'm not aware of any evidence for that.
It was not anti-British and anti-European government.
No, it didn't. It was directed against the Coast Moles.
And how is it that the European community, definitely by the beginning of 1916, I mean, and possibly earlier, I haven't gone into the evidence, they believe that it was aimed at them. And Bonar Law used this as an argument. He said it was premeditated and that it was aimed against them. He used this in the House of Commons.
I doubt that premeditation against the British, but when they had broken out, erupted into this violence against the Coast Moors, they were quite ready to go a little further and attack either burghers or British or anybody else to make a little money out of it.
Yes, but this was a general defiance of authority.
Yes.
Whereas the European community feared that they would be attacked too.
Oh yes, there was a fear of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was rather sort of magnified fear?
You mean that it was...
They made too much of it.
I think perhaps they made too much of it. As I told you, this was coincided in date with that mutiny in the two Sikh regiments in Singapore. I think a good many people suspected that there was German money behind that, and that there might be German money behind the one in Ceylon.
So that was a sort of underlying rumor in the British community.
It might be a fear. I don't know the rumor exactly, but there was, I think some people feared that.
Oh, you heard some people talk
about it? I can't remember hearing, but I think there was that feeling.
That feeling. And as for instigation, who do you think instigated it?
I have no idea, no positive idea on that kind. But in later years, at the time, I suspected nobody in particular. But in later years, when I found that the uprising against the Tamils led to very specific attacks on people like the two Brahmin priests in Panadura, that led me to suspect that some priests were behind it. That later one. The Tamil...
Yeah, that's 1958.
And if it was so in 1958, it may also have been so in 1915. I don't know, it's only a guess. You know those two Brahmin priests
were
burnt alive on the streets in Panadura. And that was part of the jealousy, because people were beginning to appreciate them and go to their temple and leave. People who used to be purely supporters of Rankot Vihara had begun to go to this Tamil temple.
You say that you doubt whether the government considered Sinhala Buddhist leaguers organized the outbreak. You don't think they... But then why did they arrest them? Regarding the 1915 riots, do you know if it was on Daubigin's advice that Senanayake and company were arrested?
I don't know it.
Who was Forrest?
Forrest was a magistrate.
Oh, in Colombo, police magistrate.
Yes.
You think that if they had been able to put down the riots in Colombo early, if they had adopted a firm policy in Colombo.
Or in Kandy, you mean?
In both places, where they would they have been able to nip the riots in the bud, so to speak?
Well, I doubt it. But it was a slight mistake. At Colombo, they arrested three fellows for throwing stones at the railway on that very first night of the riot. And then when the crowds grew bigger, they let them go.
I see. So,
point of fact, I don't think there was much evidence against them. There wasn't anything wrong about letting them go. But anyhow, that was probably misjudged and may have helped to encourage the uprising.
Because the distinct impression I get is that they were rather weak at the outset, the first few days.
That was the impression that I got by hearsay about Kandy.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that about Colombo.
I thought in Colombo they were rather weak in
that. Except for this letting off those three boys who threw stones, who at the railway porters in Maradava. Yes. I don't know any weakness.
This is what Bowles says, and Bowles says it by pure coincidence. The colonial secretary and the governor were away, and Daubigin was on his way to Kandy. So there was no one who was able to give the order to willing to give the order to shoot.
There wasn't anything to shoot for that night, first night.
I see.
And Daniel was there. Daniel was not a weak man.
Who was he?
Superintendent of police. And the other was not a weak man. He was there, I think.
And you know, as regarding the Commission of Inquiry, what would you say about the view that the Commission found every person had been executed by the courts martial had been justly condemned.
I don't believe the commission found any such thing. Mm-hmm. What they held was, it's called my recollection, that whatever was done in good faith, mm-hmm. following the orders from the general.
I see. And you wouldn't agree with either with the view that only one person lost his life accidentally?
No, I wouldn't agree with that at all.
Oh, yes. You mentioned the fact that in one of your flying columns, gun went off accidentally.
Killed a man.
And do you know of any other instances?
Not personally, but I'd heard of some. I don't know exactly what.
Was it man?
I'll tell you something else that might interest you. Just to remember that. Apropos of the idea that there was some premeditation and organization. Mm-hmm. I went to the Orient Club, met T.P. Adigala one day in the earlier riots. Uh-huh. Then he drove me and he said, I'll give you a lift home. But he said, I must go first to the Maradala police barracks, I have business there. So he drove me there. When we were entering there, out came from the IGP's office, F.R. Sengenaiga. And the crowd raised a tremendous cheer. He had gone to interview Doug Bigging or somebody there, I don't know who, and the crowd raised a great cheer. Then on the way home, we passed Borella Junction, found a crowd of people looting a boutique there. T.P. Adigala and I in the car. And I said to T.P., here's our chance, we can shoot them. They're in the act. Go and fetch some constables from the station just at that corner. So he went and he found hardly any policemen. One policeman came out and all the ammunition locked up. And that policeman had only a gun with blank cartridge. Mm-hmm. So he and the policeman walked towards the rioters, and I went up in the car, driven by TP's driver, shouted at the people. I had a revolver. Mm-hmm. I've never in my life fired a revolver. And the constable came and poked his bayonet at some of the fellas, and they bought it. That I went after him in the car, and
why did you shoot?
Well, a lot of women and children there too, and also some of them might have been just looking. I don't know if men were shooting. I saw the crowd.
It was night, was it?
No, it didn't. I pursued them a little way. Some of the leaders who had sticks and saved and up towards Al Maradana, and then they went off the side road, and then I came back. It turned out that inspector had disobeyed.
Yeah, this is W.A. de Silva.
W.A. de Silva's nephew.
Oh.
He had disobeyed the orders to issue ball.
Oh, I see.
And he was sacked for it.
He was court-martialed, I think.
Was he?
Well, you know, in a police sense, he was, yes.
He was sacked for it. And that event was made in ground in Ramanathan's book for attacking me and T.P. Adigala.
Well, I read the book. He doesn't criticize you as such. He brings, you see, he in his appendix, he quotes this W. de Silva's version of the thing.
Yes.
And there's no criticism of you there, but he's...
I remember buying the book with the order to sue him for libel. But when I found it wasn't much of a libel, I didn't do anything.
Yes. But I may know that W. de Silva was unjustly dismissed from the service. That's what he tries to make out.
I see.
It's not...
Well, total false, you see. But I want to mention
that... Reading between the lines, I thought he was dismissed for giving blank cartridges. Funny. I thought that myself.
Yes, well, but he was.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. But he doesn't say it, but I read between the...
But I mention this, let you remind you that W.A. de Silva was one of the leaders of the Buddhists at the time. He was a mild man, he wouldn't have done anything like this himself, but a little bit suspicious that his Napier should be in sympathy with the rioters.
Regarding this order, take no prisoners, you think that was the factor that led to lots of these shootings?
Yes, I think so.
And Malcolm was definitely the person who issued
it? I believe so. I don't know for sure, but I believe so.
But surely the governor had some sort of control over Malcolm?
No. Martial law, he gives the power to him.
Yes, but he could advise the
person. He could too, but I mean, you give him the power to the general, you leave it to him.
And you say Malcolm was a bit of a joke?
Or? He's supposed to be off his head.
Off his head.
I mean, that was the general impression
later on.
When you got to know him, more about him.
How long had he been in Ceylon?
I don't know how long he'd been in Ceylon.
Of course, did you know of it then, that he was a bit eccentric?
I think I knew. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
And so, definitely in several cases, you know that this patrol shot people on the spot. Court martial.
I don't personally, I didn't see it,
but you've heard.
There was ample reason to believe it, yes.
And in, was it Charlie Lovell's case? You said that.
Well, I don't want to mention the name. It might be a life role, you know.
this Punjab, he couldn't, it was a Punjabi sergeant who conducted the shooting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It would never occur to Charlie to do that. he was a man like me, only you and me. You know what I mean? A harmless sportsman.
Mm-hmm. And also, do you believe that the Moors took this opportunity of bringing evidence against people, against their enemies, and sometimes they secured convictions by false means?
Very hard to believe that. They may have charged their enemies, but that they were, the judges were fooled by them is rather hard to believe.
No, I'm not thinking of the judges. I was thinking of sometimes in this case of, I know in one case in Ramanathan's book, I don't know how far it's true, one of these executions on the spot was on the evidence of a Moor.
Yes, that might be. In fact, there was some reason to believe that a Roman Catholic chap named Leo Fernando was unjustly executed.
Oh, I see. Because also I read in Solomon Das Bandaranaike's book, and he's by no means critical of government on this issue. He says that one of his overseers was accused by Moors and jailed, in fact. Whereas he was fortunate, his overseer was able to prove conclusively that he was in Kandy.
Yeah.
Whereas he
could be, could be.
I remember
acquitting one lot. Myself, they were tried before me. One Mormon came and charged a lot of people, including one of the proctors, or the proctor's clerk. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite sure about it, so I acquitted him, but there might be such cases.
Now, Sir John Anderson, when he came, he said that he examined certain particular cases, and he thought the decisions there taken, I don't know whether it's by the courts or the courts martial, had been very bad. What would you say about the view that Anderson, in these cases, was fooled by cases which were specially engineered and concocted by lawyers?
I shouldn't think so. No.
You think his judgment was fair? He was a man of
sound? I think they had done some very wrong things.
Mm-hmm. Was Anderson unpopular among civil servants largely because of this?
I think so. Uh-huh. But also he was unpopular for other reasons too.
What other
reasons? I don't quite remember what it was. I was out of station then. Mm-hmm. At least no, I wasn't out of station. I hadn't got anything much to do with him. I never came into contact with him.
There is distinct evidence that the railway workers and also some workers from mercantile firms led the riots in the sense that they came by tram and they broke into some shops and then everyone else joined in.
Yes, I remember one case in which a sort of head clerk employed by one of the harbour firms led some people in. I tried it myself and found him guilty. Mm-hmm. And Ennis acquitted him.
Yes.
Wrongfully.
Oh, I see.
There was a case where Moore himself gave evidence. You know, Moore the civil servant?
Yes, sir.
Against this man. Can't remember his name.
But, you see, In 1912, these railway workers, especially the skilled workers at the locomotive workshops, had struck work.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had given up the strike on the promise that their demands would be considered.
Mm-hmm.
But the commission met, and the salaries that were granted, well, their decision was the decisions were hardly generous by the workers, and
mm-hmm.
they were still discontent, and there's proof. So, won't it be fair to say that this government's failure to give any concessions at this stage had caused some industrial unrest in Colombo, which had a bearing on the riots? If government
might be so, I'm not sure. I don't know of it. I do remember that there was some dissatisfaction among the railway men over the discontinuance of some men, not about salaries.
That was before the riots?
Yes.
Yes. Well, yes, there was some discontent. Definitely in 1912, I think it was, I'm not quite certain about the cause. But there was a commission which was on this, which was